morning. We're delighted to welcome you all to the Supreme Court hearing room. We have today special guests, Port Washington High School students. Would they please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. Are here with a national award-winning program sponsored by the state court and by the State Bar of Wisconsin. If students wish to take up the court's invitation to come to the court, then the students are given material about the case and may engage in some activities relating to the judicial system or the particular case. They come to court, and then at noon, or I should say after the second case, which is usually 12:15 or thereabouts, the students meet with the justice assigned by the court to meet with them for that day. There's a discussion right after the second case. The discussion with the justice relates to the procedure of taking a case, hearing a case, and issuing an opinion. The discussion does not include a discussion of the substantive issues in any case discussed today or previously. Everyone's invited to attend that session at noon, not only the students. I want to know if anyone here would like a copy of a summary of the case we are about to hear. If you raise your hand, the marshal will bring you a summary. None are raised. So I will go on to introduce the court to you all. On my far left is Justice Michael Gableman. Seated next to him is Justice Patience Rogensack. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To Justice Bradley's right is Justice David Prosser, and it is Justice Prosser with whom you will meet after this case. And on the far right, Justice Annette Ziegler. With those introductions made, I'll call our second case for today. 2013 AP 1023 Adam R. Is it Mayhew versus State of Wisconsin. Arguing on behalf of Mr. Mayhew is Nicholas Andrew Wagner, and arguing on behalf of the state is Assistant Attorney General Carla Keckhaber. And then Mr. Wagner, you will have 5 minutes in rebuttal. You may proceed, counsel.
Good morning. We're here today because on July 1st of 2010, Mr. Mayhew was attending a baseball game at the Red Granite Correctional Facility, and he was a spectator in which he was directed to sit along the first baseline in bleachers that were provided by the correctional facility. And while he was a spectator, he was hit with a loose ball in his head, and he suffered severe and permanent injuries as a result of that injury. The issues we're here to address today are whether or not the Department of Corrections is considered an independent agency as a result of the scope of the statutory powers that were provided to it in Wisconsin Statutes 301 et al. And related to that is the nature of how sovereign immunity is going to play a role in determining whether or not the state of Wisconsin or the Department of Corrections has any liability as a result of Mr. Mayhew's injury that occurred on that day.
Counsel, could I ask you, what was the specific date of the incident?
I believe it was July 1st of 2010.
And what was the first day that there was any kind of notice of claim?
Notice of claim, I believe one was sent out fairly close to the expiration of the 120-day period.
Within?
Within the 120-day period.
Well, your brief says October 21st, 2011.
Then I probably have the date wrong of the injury.
Okay. Well, that's rather important.
In determining whether or not an agency of this stage is an independent agency, there's been a number of cases that have addressed that. The primary one that started the theory would have been Lister versus the Board of Regents. And in that case, the law was established that that certain agencies of the state can be considered independent and therefore they are not subject to sovereign immunity as a result of their status. And we're here arguing that today that the Wisconsin Department of Corrections is in fact an independent agency based on its vast powers. In Sullivan, some of the factors that were looked at were whether or not it was a political corporation, and in this case, we believe that the Department of Corrections in this case is essentially a political corporation based on the two statutes of 301.02 and 301.04, in which the Wisconsin legislature directed in Wisconsin statute 301.02 that the Department of Corrections shall govern. And combined with that in Wisconsin statute 301.04, they granted the power to sue and be sued. Additional factors that are looked at were developed in a later case, and that was Majerus.
I have just a question. I did not look this up, but are there many state agencies or departments that have similar language, sue and be sued? What about the DNR?
There are a couple other agencies that do have the language of sue and be sued. The primary distinction, though, is there are, at least when I last looked at this, no agencies that were given the direct power to govern. So it's the combination of those two statutes, Wisconsin Statute 301.02 and 301.04, that I believe set the precedence that it was the legislative intent to create the Department of Corrections as an independent agency primarily designed to regulate the prison population of Wisconsin.
Counsel, your opposing counsel on page 8 of the red brief has different agencies listed, and you say the difference between these agencies vis-a-vis the sue and be sued language is that, for instance, the technical college doesn't have the power to govern. Is that what you're suggesting? Or?
The statutory language of given directly the power to govern is a unique power among the Department of Corrections as compared to other agencies. At least when I was going, and there's a lot of statutes, but that was in particular something that I was looking for while I was doing this.
And, others are listed as Department of Health and Social Services, Department of Children and Families, Department of Safety and Professional Services. I mean, I haven't looked at those.
My recollection is, Justice Bradley, is they do not have the power to govern.
Okay. Just checking.
You know, I could be incorrect, but that was when I started this process of looking into the independent agency theory, it was that factor alone that stood out in my mind. And I did go through, when I started this process 4 years ago, going through the statutes to determine really how many agencies have that. And that was a unique power to the Department of Corrections.
It says the department shall maintain and govern the state correctional institutions. Similar power not in the in the Board of Regents?
No, not to my recollection.
Mm-hmm. So on the basis of governing that, you're going to argue it's a it falls under independent agent in effect.
It, it falls under what the prior case law of this court has held, is that it's a political corporation in a sense.
Okay.
What that sense is, I think needs to be determined, but if you have the power to govern, it would be a meaningless power if you weren't some recognized body or some recognized entity.
I can't believe that the University of Wisconsin Board of Regents doesn't have the power to determine it owns thousands of acres and that it doesn't have the power to govern the thousand of acres. It doesn't have the power to govern the hundreds of buildings, maybe thousands of buildings occupied by the University of Wisconsin across the state.
I could be mistaken, but I can tell you I did march through that process starting from the beginning of the statutes, going through these agencies to look for that, and you know, I could have missed
it. Not explicitly in the statutes.
Not to my recollection.
My question is, isn't it implicit? If it's not implicit, then what are they doing governing these institutions? You don't have to answer. That's rhetorical.
I will tell you, I don't have an answer for you.
I know you don't. I mean, I think that's the point. If you're relying on governing, and I will ask the Assistant Attorney General that, if you're relying on the fact that they can govern the institution, meaning the prison up in Green Bay, War Pond, Oak Park is called now. I mean, there are dozens of facilities. Some prisons, some farms, and the DOC governs those institutions, right? That was what that statute means to you?
Right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So moving on, and basically my analysis really follows the outlines of the prior case law that came out by this court, and some of the two factors that were considered to be an independent agency. Obviously, Majerus referenced the fact that they were a corporate political body and they had the power to be sued and be sued. Other factors that were recognized as being determinative of whether or not an agency was independent was whether they had the power to convey real estate, dispose of personal property, things like that. So if you look at the statutory scope of powers of the Wisconsin Department of Corrections, it's a very broad set of powers. If you look at it and you want to break it down into camps, I mean, I think I've summarized about 19 of them. But they boil down into a couple camps. They have a judicial power. In other words, they can subpoena power, they can have hearings, they review decisions or rules that are implemented by the Department of Corrections. They have the ability to contract. They can enter into contracts with the federal court. They can enter contracts with other states. They can contract to purchase and sell real estate. They can establish, another aspect is there's can develop their own educational system under 30106. They're to provide religious background or religious opportunities under 301.065 for the inmates. They have the authority to write checks from public funds under 301.075. They can purchase care and services, and they can restructure debt, refinance buildings under 301.235. They have the ability to enforce judgments under 301.12.
Do you know if they sue someone and get a judgment, does the money just go back to DOC?
I wouldn't have a clear answer on how the public funds work. I mean, there's provisions in there that say that there's a provision in here, if my recollection serves me correctly, where they can take funds and deposit them directly into the general fund because There's a statutory authority that I believe allows them.
I'm trying to get at what's their financial independence? You know, if they sue someone or if they are sued. Let's say they're sued and someone in judgment enters against them. If they're at the end of their budget cycle and they don't have any money, does that just sit out there as an empty judgment? Well, I'm trying to figure out what sue and to be sued means and whether that connotes the kind of independence you're urging us to adopt.
Well, here's what I'll tell you. If the litmus test is whether or not an agency is considered independent and because they are totally financially independent from the government or the general fund, then we never get to an independent agency because that's not going to happen. There's always going to be some financial tie to the state fund because it's a tax-driven organization. It's designed to regulate the prison population for the safety of the citizens of Wisconsin.
So give me your test. What's the test as to when we analyze an agency, whether we know if it's independent or not?
The test, to me, is under the case law, is what is the statutory character of this agency? And this statutory character of this agency is to conduct itself like a small political corporation, like a small town municipality. They have all the necessary requirements. Does it look and act like a political organization? Does it look like it can do what the city of Appleton can do? That's the test. That's the character. And the litmus test already decided is it's not necessarily significant whether or not the umbilical cord between the agency and the general fund from the state has been severed. That's not the litmus test. And probably, I think it was Metzinger or Majerus that mentioned that that's not the final rule. The test is, does the character of the agency operate itself independently of the state? And in this case, I believe that based on the fact that they have the power to contract, they have a judicial, they have enforcement, they have an educational system, a religious system, that this is a small political organization that's conducting itself independently in regulating the prison population and controlling it. Their obligation really is to provide reports back to the administrative agency on what's going on, but that, other than the financial tie in that, they're up and operating on their own.
Okay, so you would employ a totality of the circumstances type test.
Well, that's the test that's currently available to us, unless this court decides to restructure that test after this case. But the test is what is the character? Majera said, here's a quote, "It is the character of the agency that is relevant." That's the test. And so, yes, in a sense, it's the totality of circumstances. If that's how the court wants to define it, that would be it.
Can you think of any departments that aren't independent?
The Board of Licensing. You know, in my mind...
Is the Board of Licensing a department?
I believe that it has some statutory powers under the administrative wing. Currently...
DOA? Wouldn't that be the Department of... I'm not trying to give you a hard time. I'm trying to figure out
how we
make this...
I don't remember the name of license, but if you're going to go get a license as a chiropractor or a doctor, there's an agency in place to monitor and regulate and provide licenses and oversee, whether or not chiropractors are in accordance with the licensing requirements, but that agency would not. There are a number of them. I mean, I don't have them off the top of my head, but I would say that there are a lot of agencies that are not independent. I would say the majority of the agencies in Wisconsin are not independent.
You use the word agency and department interchangeably?
I probably am.
Well, the Department of Licensing does have judicial power. They hold hearings.
They do have power and they do hold hearings, but they're not given the statutory powers to govern and buy and sell real estate. I mean, the scope of the powers is not as vast as the Department of Corrections. And I would say that another agency approaching independence would probably be the Department of Natural Resources.
And DNR. They right. have the
I
right.
I think they're approaching that if you look at...
I didn't mean DR. I meant DOA. They have the power to contract.
Right. They have...
They sign all the leases.
Correct.
They can contract. They can lease. Don't they have the administrative hearings under them?
They do.
Yeah, okay. Have an enforcement system?
I'm sorry?
An enforcement system?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
If we were to conclude that the Department of Corrections was not an independent agency, do you lose?
I think that in this case, and under the circumstances of the way that Mr. Mayhew was injured, unless this court is going to tackle the historical approach to sovereign immunity, I think I'm out. I think Mr. Mayhew doesn't have a remedy.
Well, you did originally name certain officials, including the Secretary of Corrections and the warden at Red Granite.
I did. There was, and I'll tell the court, when this first case first came to me, it was one of those cases where you struggle to determine whether or not there's a remedy based on all the immunities that are available. I looked at whether or not there was a 1983 action in federal court. I looked at a bunch of possibilities. Ultimately, I feel that, and I know where the court's going with this, is whether or not there's a remedy under that. And I felt that the act of directing Mr. Mayhew to sit on a bench that was already existing, that had no safety in place, the officer of Red Granite just sitting there is more of a discretionary act. It's not a ministerial act, and I felt that that avenue of recovery was fruitless. And so when you look at how to approach these, it becomes difficult as a lawyer to determine what area you're going to have the most success or the most impact because of the amount of immunity that you have to go through. And I believe to this date that it was not a negligent act of a negligent ministerial act in Mr. Mayhew's case.
What?
This was a baseball game. The way you phrase things in your brief was to suggest that the authorities at the institution said, Mr. Mayhew, you sit in this particular place and watch this game. Is that really accurate?
Well, they are directed to, if you are going to be a spectator at a game, they
are
directed.
Did he have to be a spectator?
Huh?
Did he have to be a spectator?
No, Mr. Mayhew opted to that day that he would sit and watch baseball. Either you're playing baseball. I mean, I don't know exactly because we haven't got to do discovery or anything, but my understanding from my client is that he wanted to watch baseball that day, and they are directed to go over to the bleachers and sit and watch on that area along the first baseline.
And so is the argument basically that the prison didn't provide safe facilities for him to watch the game, or what is the essence of the argument?
The essence of the argument is that if they are going to direct a location for spectators to sit and watch these baseball games, they ought to be protected from loose balls coming through into the bleacher and pegging them on the head. And not having that safety makes them liable, in my opinion.
If you were sitting at Miller Park and there was a line drive from the batter into the stands and it hit somebody in the head, are the Brewers automatically liable for that?
Well, I'm not a big baseball fan, but but my understanding from seeing the Brewers facility is, though, and having talking to some people that design this, they do have an area that they can tell where there's a high probability of loose balls flying, and so at least they're designed in that, and there are screens in front or some protection available. But the proximity to, from what my understanding, where Mr. Mayhew was seated, I mean, it was definitely in a high probable area where someone could get hit by the ball. And information to me now, I mean, it's not going to, if this goes back, it's not, you know, probably won't be an evidentiary issue, but they have changed the design of what the spectators do. There is now protection and coverage there. So, that's the essence of my negligence claim.
You said that if the DOC is not held as a separate agency, you think you're out. I thought part of your argument here was that the language sue and be sued is a waiver of the constitutional sovereign immunity.
I believe it is. I know that historically this court has held that there has to be an express intent, but and this court addressed that issue in Hoyts, and I hope I'm saying the case name right, that, you know, this court in Hoyts created the idea that tort immunity is the rule and that there's a substantive cause of action. And
are you talking about Hollitz?
Hollitz. That's how you say it. So
it's a city case.
Right. City of Milwaukee. That there's a substantive cause of action created as a result of abolishing tort immunity. Hello, the state of Wisconsin is subject to sovereign immunity, and that your ruling in that case did not remove that. I believe that the sue and sued be language is an illusionary statute. I mean, there's no cases interpreting it. It sits there. And I know that the Department of Justice is arguing that it's just it gives them the right or the capacity to participate in court proceedings. But it's kind of like a statute that isn't mean anything if it's just you can be a person and appear in court, especially when you look at they have the right to govern. And it's the combination of those two that, to me, in light of the fact that these statutes were created after Hollitz, in which this court established a substantive right of tort liability against governments. And so my red light's on, so I don't
know. Well, but is the city comparable to the state in sovereign immunity? Or is the city a separate entity because it has all these powers?
Well, I think what the comparison is that a city, as compared to the state of Wisconsin, is they're both municipal organizations, or they are political organizations, or they're government organizations. I mean, I think in that sense, they're the same. And so I have a from Hollitz, I have a small quote in which this court said, there will be substantive liability on part of the state But that right to sue the state is subject to Section 27, Article 4. So a substantive tort liability was created way back in the 60s. And, you know, the court also referenced at that point in time that the legislation was going to be created, a tort liability statute. I mean, nothing's been done. The legislation has been complacent, you know, for almost 50 years regarding whether or not they're going to direct how the state's going to be sued. I mean, my take on it is that they have failed to provide a procedure in place when this court talked about it back in Hollitz, and this court has granted a substantive right back then, but it's illusionary. Nobody can do anything. There's a right, and you can't get to it because the legislator hasn't done anything in almost 50 years.
Well, they did something in 89382, which is an old statute. That's a new numbering that provided a procedure for suing not the state, but an officer.
An officer, but not the state. And I believe in 89380, where you can sue, this court held in Townsend that statute doesn't apply to the state. So there's a substantive right there for Mr. Mayhew, but he is not able to exercise that substantive right at this point in time because the legislator has failed to provide direction on how to be sued. And I don't read that constitutional provision myself as saying that they're immune. It's just that they have to direct a procedure. And this court can, in Adegami versus provide a procedure when the court fails to, or when the legislator fails to provide that procedure, if there's a substantive right available, and in this case there is. So that would be a second avenue of recovery, either the independent agency or a direction to the legislator on how individuals can sue the state for substantive rights.
Where do you find the substantive right available?
In Hollitz, the court created that right.
Thank you, counsel.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Wisconsin Assistant Attorney General Carla Keycaver, and I represent the defendant respondent, the Wisconsin Department of Corrections. This court should affirm the Court of Appeals and conclude that the Department of Corrections is entitled to sovereign immunity for two reasons. First, the Department of Corrections is a cabinet agency. It's completely dependent on the state for obtaining appropriations, spending, purchasing real estate, and other important functions. It has none of the characteristics of an independent state agency. Instead, it's an arm of the state, and it's entitled to the state's immunity. Second, there has to be clear and express legislative consent to waive sovereign immunity in tort. But the legislature hasn't taken this action with respect to the Department of Corrections. The sue and be sued provision in DOC's enabling statute is not a clear and express waiver of sovereign immunity in tort. Instead, it simply relates to an entity's capacity to be a party to a lawsuit. The sue and be sued provision is not a waiver of sovereign immunity in tort for three reasons. First, the provision has an entirely different purpose. It relates to an entity's capacity to be a party to a lawsuit. It doesn't create a cause of action, and it doesn't on its own waive sovereign immunity. So, for example, the individual DOC prisons don't have the capacity to sue and be sued, but the legislature has designated the Department of Corrections as the entity that can sue and be sued. And similarly, the UW Board of Regents, with all of its programmatic responsibilities, has the capacity to sue and be sued, but the individual campuses don't have that capacity. So this provision, the sue and be sued provision, is an express legislative delegation that lets plaintiffs know which entities can be sued. And
why would you want to sue them if it's not going to give you a result?
Because they will have a result for certain types of actions, like a contract action under Section 775.01, where the legislature has expressly waived waived sovereign immunity for suits against the state when the state is alleged to be a debtor, or for a claim under Section 103 of the Family Medical Leave Act, where the legislature has waived sovereign immunity so long as the employee is successful in an administrative claim and on judicial review. So what it does is it allows the entity to do business, including contracting with vendors, and it lets the vendor know that that the entity is capable of doing business and will stand by its promises. And then the vendor knows what entity to sue so long as the vendor has a cause of action for which the legislature has waived sovereign immunity, like Chapter 775.
Counsel, what is your answer that provides some measure of justice to a person like Mr. Mayhew? As I read your opponent's brief, Mr. Mayhew suffered injuries including, but not limited to, a fracture of his right temporal lobe and severed artery, which further resulted in a hematoma, blood clot, strokes, and acute respiratory failure. Okay. Now, if I were that person in the institution, I would want some kind of remedy for this. What is your answer?
His remedy is to sue the individual state employees for damages, and that remedy is available to him, so long as he follows certain procedural requirements. But that remedy was foreclosed to him because he failed to file a notice of claim. So unlike the state and state agencies, damage actions are available against individual state employees as long as certain procedural requirements are met. And those requirements include filing a notice of claim within 120 days of the event, no punitive damages, and compensatory damages that are capped at $250,000.
Well, now, he's suffering strokes here. I'm sure he's in the hospital. And so your position is that he has to follow a particular statute within 120 days, or the real injuries he suffered are, well, too bad, so sad.
That's the system the legislature has established. And this court in Hollis allowed for that. When the court abrogated governmental immunity, the court explicitly said that the legislature was free to reenact governmental immunity or to establish damage caps or notice requirements. And that's what the legislature promptly did for state employees, once it became clear that state employees weren't covered by sovereign immunity, and did nothing for the state or state agencies because they were covered by sovereign immunity.
Okay, but that, you had Hollitz in the early 60s. Okay, and the Department of Corrections wasn't created until a long time after that. And the statute creating the Department of Corrections said they can sue or be sued. That's pretty broad language.
That's correct. But the Department of Corrections in the 60s was not created, and the prisons were run by the Department of Health and Social Services at the time, which had a sue and be sued provision. So at that time, the sue and be sued provision was enacted pre-Hollitz. The state enjoyed two types of immunity in tort: sovereign immunity and government immunity. And there would have been no reason for the legislature to waive sovereign immunity in tort when the government, or when the state still had sovereign immunity in tort. So that can't be what the legislature intended. So, and because DOC's sue and be sued statute is based on DHSS's sue and be sued statute, the reasoning of Lindis v. Cady, which is what held that the sue and be sued provision was not a waiver of sovereign immunity, is persuasive because it's based on the same statute.
Why should a tort victim be able to sue an independent agency if they're suffered, but they just can't sue the state itself?
Because the independent agency is not the state. It's considered not the state. It has certain characteristics that make it unlike the state. It's been expressly.
What's so big about the state here? I mean, they're running the whole show here in the institution.
I'm sorry, I missed the first part.
What is so great about the state? They're running the whole institution. I suspect Mr. Mayhew didn't want to be there. The facilities, in other words, if they poisoned him with his food, create a list of horribles, and you would say, that's tough. There's nothing you can do about it.
Well, there's not nothing. He could sue the individual state employees for their actions, and the state would indemnify those employees.
What's the purpose of sovereign immunity? Why does it even exist?
Well, it's to protect the state budget is probably the main reason. And it is a constitutional doctrine. You know, unlike governmental immunity, which is a common law doctrine, sovereign immunity is a constitutional doctrine. It's in Article 4, Section 27 of the Wisconsin Constitution, which directs the legislature to direct by law in what manner and in what court suits may be brought against the state. And that brings me to another reason why sue and be sued is not a waiver of sovereign immunity. That provision says nothing about the manner and courts in which suits can be brought against the state. It's unlike other provisions which expressly waive sovereign immunity for certain types of actions, like Chapter 775, which we talked about earlier, which waives sovereign immunity for contract claims where the state is alleged to be a debtor so long as certain procedural requirements are met. And Chapter 103 of the Family Medical Leave Act, which waives sovereign immunity so long as the employee is successful in an administrative action and on judicial review. Those are expressly talk about the manner in courts, which soon be sued does not do.
I want to go back to Justice Prosser's discussion with you. And the repeated answer, which is correct, I think, is that the state allowed a suit against the employee. But who pays for when the plaintiff sues the employee? Who pays? The state. So it's all a fiction. It's all a fiction. And the house of cards just falls because what the state has done is said, well, if you do it this particular way, we're going to pay you, right? So why isn't that a waiver? And I know you're going to say it's not a waiver because it's not express. And then you have to have express. Well, I found FDIC versus Meyer, 510 U.S. 471, page 480, where the court said, despite the general rule that waivers of sovereign immunity are to be read narrowly in favor of the sovereign, sue and be sued clauses are simple and broad and cannot be limited by implication unless there's been a clear showing that certain types of suits are not consistent with the statutory or constitutional scheme. And it goes on to say, hey, look, this is the purpose of this is not to protect the government under against its negligence. Right? So what's the matter with saying that the sue and be sued language here is a waiver? And I'm not, that's my first part, I'm not persuaded about when sue and be sued came into effect, because every year these statute books are reprinted and redone. They travel with the new laws and the new views and the new circumstances. Right. So under the new law, rules and new circumstances and how it's, et cetera, and the concept that the government ought to be liable for when it errs and when its employees are, you know, I'm not persuaded that you're limiting sue and be sued. Makes sense. And that you're not, that this is all built on a fiction.
Okay, I think your question, your first question was whether indemnification is a waiver?
Yeah.
I believe, I could be wrong.
That's another way of stating it, and it's very simply stated that way.
I believe Fiala v. Voigt held that it was not a waiver.
Maybe that case was wrong.
Okay, could be. But I believe that the Supreme Court held that in 1980, but I'm not positive. As to your second question about sue and be sued and whether simply reenacting that provision, I think the Department of Corrections is a special case here because it does appear over 20 times in the Wisconsin statutes for a number of different agencies, as stated in my brief. But I think the Department of Corrections is a special situation here because the Department of Corrections was, the prisons were run by this other agency. So it's the exact same provision. And in the legislative history, it says that this provision is based on this prior provision from DHSS. So that would be my response to that. I'm not sure if there's more of a response that you're looking for there.
Well, I think there are cases that would indicate that a particular statute has to be read in the present context, not necessarily when it was passed in 1892, and that you look at it, how it operates today and under the facts today, and not necessarily limited to the past.
Then I would look at the plain language of the statute, and I would look at it in context of the language of Article 4, Section 27, and the fact that it does not describe the manner, what manner and what court suits can be brought against the state. You know, it simply says that DOC can sue and be sued. It doesn't say anything about manner in court. So even without Lindis v. Cady, I think it's persuasive that it says nothing about manner in courts like other waivers do.
And by your referencing Forseth.
Pardon me?
You're referencing the requirement that appears to be set forth in Forseth when you discuss manner and...
Well, that's right in Article 4, Section 27.
And Forseth.
That could be, I'm not sure.
Well, paragraph 374 gives us one of the reasons for immunity, the constitutional admonition that the legislature shall direct by law in what manner and in what court suits may be brought against the state. And so that is both the constitutional and the case law requirement that you are saying is not present in this instance.
That's correct.
One of the things that I've found unusual over the years is the legislative directive on how it treats state employees differently than other governmental employees. But it seems to be pretty darn specific. When I was a circuit court judge and you'd have a slip and fall case or whatever, dealing with the city hall and suing some employees in addition to the city. You had a notice provision, very specific notice provision that says 120 days, but specifically says essentially, but if you miss it and there's no prejudice, it's okay. Mm-hmm. Now, this statute with regard to state employees is very specific. Justice Prosser is asking about that. It says it has to be strictly complied with, and it doesn't have this, if no notice, it's okay. Why is the state treating the governmental subdivision employees differently than the state employees vis-a-vis the notice requirement? Do you know the rationale for that?
Well, Well, to be honest with you, I wasn't aware of the municipality that it was interpreted differently, that it was less strict. But the case law interprets 893.82 to require strict compliance, and I believe it goes back to the policies behind that statute, which is cost controls.
Yes, I understand that. I always thought it was just the state protecting its own, and it didn't quite have the same generosity of spirit, depending on what the focus of the generosity is, vis-a-vis the political subdivision employees. But
so is it 893.80 that's not interpreted as strictly?
I think it's 893.801D, if I recall correctly. I mean, I think around there that deals with this, you know, no prejudice. That's okay. Is my recollection.
How do you think the federal cases construe sue and be sued differently than the state of Wisconsin has in Majerus?
I think the federal cases are distinguishable for two reasons. First, the context is different. The federal cases are the sovereign immunity in the federal cases is based on federal common law, whereas the state cases are based on the specific provisions of Article 4, Section 27 of the Wisconsin Constitution. And there's no indication that the waiver analysis in these two different contexts is the same. In fact, in Burr, the Supreme Court said that the rationale for finding waiver in the federal cases is not applicable to municipalities, counties, and the like. And then the second reason is that the federal cases were ultimately focused on the independent proprietary nature of the agencies involved. So all of the agencies in these cases had some degree of independence from the U.S. government. They were the U.S. Postal Service, the FDIC, the Federal Housing Authority. And the plaintiffs in many of these cases were wanting to treat the agencies like a private business. So in Loeffler, the plaintiff wanted prejudgment interest on his Title VII case. And in Burr, the plaintiff wanted to initiate a garnishment action. So these cases were different in character than the case at issue here because the plaintiff wanted to treat the agency like a private business. So I think those things make the federal cases distinguishable from the present case here. Because DOC is not an independent state agency. So, and I'll address that now because I think opposing counsel was focused on that, and he did indicate that he thought that if DOC is not an independent state agency that he loses this case. So I do want to address that. So the sue and be sued provision is not a waiver of sovereign immunity, as I said. It instead relates to an entity's capacity to be a party to a lawsuit. But it can be relevant to whether an entity is an independent state entity. It's one factor there. But DOC is not an independent state entity because it has no other characteristics of an independent state entity. So all of the three agencies that courts have found to be independent in Wisconsin, in Majerus, Warren, and Barr, the courts found that those agencies had the capacity to sue and be sued, and they were expressly found in the statutes to be bodies corporate and or politic. So it wasn't some other test. It was expressly in the statutes that they were bodies corporate and or politic. And DOC, as we've been talking about, has the power to sue and be sued, but it's never been found to be a body corporate and or politic. It's not, the legislature has not designated it as a body corporate and or politic.
I found that your page 16 says, as the courts below correctly concluded, DOC is arm of the state, like the Board of Regents, not the investment board. Both DOC and the UW are large agencies, this is page 16, charged to administer complex, important programs. They remain arms of the government, under the state's direction as to spending, obtaining appropriations, purchasing real estate, and other functions. Now, my understanding is the Board of Regents does have broad powers to purchase real estate. And if new legislation, and maybe under the old legislation as to the UW Medical School, they have powers to spend funds without following the rules generally applicable to state entities. Do you think that fits now, your language on the Board of Regents?
Well, I think DSC's powers are even more closely circumscribed than UW's.
That's what I'm asking you.
I think that's correct. I mean, DOC is a cabinet agency, so its powers to spend and to contract and to purchase goods and services are all delegated by the legislature. So they're even more closely circumscribed than UW's. And to
they
your
get
point,
almost all their money from the state.
They
the
get Board all their re- budget. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, and the Board of Regents does not.
That's correct. And
gets a minority of its money from the state.
That may be. And to your point earlier about whether the university has the power to govern, whether that's explicitly in the statutes, I didn't know the answer earlier, but I looked it up when you were asking. Mm-hmm. And under Section 3609, Responsibilities, the Board of Regents, the primary responsibility for governance of the system shall be vested in the board, and then it goes on. So
that's what I thought.
That is part of the Board
he
of Regents.
He recently had a case involving disorderly conduct relating to the Board of Regents and found that they had great powers, and I think the court may have even held that the Board of Regents is about a body politic because there was a discussion as to whether the, when I say disorderly conduct, the harassing statute or getting a restraining order, and I think the court said you had to be a body politic or to get a restraining order, and the court said the Board of Regents was, the university system was. So, I mean, we got lots of issues.
Yeah, the Board of Regents, the UW system is a body corporate.
Okay.
Under
and then
36.
You can look at 990 and see if there's any difference between body politic and body corporate. You don't have to look at it. I'm just trying to say that the stretch here.
Sure.
It's always dangerous to analogize, and the Board of Regents might be one of those.
Well taken.
Those dangers. Now, I do want to bring you back because my notes show that you had two reasons to affirm the trial court on the grounds of sovereign immunity. One is that it's a cabinet agency totally dependent on state appropriation. Mm-hmm. Two, that there was no clear waiver, and you had three arguments under no clear waiver. Mm-hmm. And you did one, that sue and be sued isn't a waiver. Two, later on you said, no procedure, no manner is set forth. So I put down as number two. Number three is?
Sorry, I was poor housekeeping on my part. Number three was that
no,
the
you were interrupted by
Katie.
Questions.
Linda C. Cady. We talked about Linda C. Cady, but the reasoning of Linda C. Cady was persuasive, and we talked about it in the questioning, so I didn't.
Right. Okay.
I didn't give it a number, but I should have.
Right.
You cited counsel, Wisconsin Statute 775.01. Read this hurriedly. If Mr. Mayhew had simply submitted a claim to the legislature and the legislature didn't pay the claim, upon the refusal of the legislature to allow a claim against the state, claimant may commence an action against the state.
Under Townsend, 775 doesn't apply in tort. So 775 wouldn't he wouldn't be able to use 775 to sue the state.
Maybe Townsend is wrong.
Maybe
maybe the Constitution, Article 4, Section 27 is wrong.
So just briefly finishing up with independent state agency, the legislature has not designated the Department of Corrections as an independent state agency. Instead, it classified DOC as a department under subchapter 2 of chapter 15 instead of as an independent state agency under subchapter 3 of chapter 15. Third, DOC's budget is entirely under the control of the legislature. It has no power to issue bonds or to invest, and it follows the same appropriations procedure under Chapter 16 as all other state agencies. It follows the same procedure under Chapter 16 as all other state agencies for purchasing goods and services, and it has to get DOA approval for purchasing and selling real estate. And finally, it cannot incur any liability beyond the amount appropriated to it by the legislature. So it pays into the state risk pool, and its claims are paid out of the state risk pool, but obtaining liability coverage through the state risk pool doesn't make DOC an independent state agency. So all of these things make DOC very different in character than the independent state agencies in Majerus, Warren, and Barr. DOC is an arm of the state, and it's entitled to the state's immunity.
What's the difference between government immunity and sovereign immunity?
Governmental immunity is a common law doctrine that applies to even municipalities. It's a broad doctrine that applies to the state and municipalities, whereas sovereign immunity is more limited. It's a constitutional doctrine that only applies to the state and its agencies.
Does the common law immunity, government immunity, apply to the state?
Does governmental immunity? It does.
How do the two fit together for the state?
Well, the state has both immunities. I mean, right now under Hollett's abrogated governmental immunity. So the state does not have governmental immunity right now under Hollett's, but it still is protected by sovereign immunity. But the concepts are often confused.
I'll say. Does the city have a sovereign immunity?
No.
Why not?
Because it's not protected by Article 4, Section 27 of the Constitution. And it's not a sovereign.
Even with home rule?
I don't think so.
I would have said because it's a separate entity.
Therefore
liable. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Wagner.
To follow up on my conclusion or my brief response here, there were a couple comments coming on the questioning that I think are relevant. I think in today, the historical context or the historical approach of looking at what an agency is and how agencies function in Wisconsin, the historical interpretation since the court was looking at it in the 60s is a little outdated because the agencies in the 60s weren't as vast or didn't have the scope of powers that are granted today based on the growing statutory code. I mean, the code,
you know, counsel, that sounds like a rather broad statement. You know, it may be true of some agencies, it may not be true of others, but it seems to me that nothing I've heard so far indicates that the principles have not remained constant. You say the 60s as if it's a long time ago. It doesn't seem that long ago. But, for instance, in Majerus, and I'm going to ask you about this so that you can help me with the concept of the Department of Corrections, in your view, being a separate body politic. Chief Justice Hallows in Majerus pointed out in regard to the Armory Board that the Armory Board, and I'm looking at page 312, Majerus, of course, is at 39 West 2nd, 311. And at page 312, the Chief Justice lays out the underlying principles of a separate body politic. First, he notes the Armory is given no appropriation. Can the same be said of the Department of Corrections?
Well, the Department of Corrections has some independent authority to collect and contract and collect money.
Right, but does the legislature, does the governor's budget and the legislature give appropriations, assign appropriations to the DOC?
My opinion is that it does.
Yes. Well, I was at the Joint Finance Committee hearing the other day, and they spoke before the court's representative did, so that's my understanding, too. Does the Department of Corrections have the power to independently borrow money?
They have the power to borrow and refinance building deals subject to the approval, my understanding is, of the administrative board. But they can go out and contract, enter into contracts, a condition of
approval. Sure. I know what you want to say, yeah. But I'm going to ask you some questions because your red light is on. Does it have the power to issue and sell bonds?
Not to my knowledge.
Not to mine either. And Chief Justice Hallows pointed out the very distinct character of the, in that case, it was the Armory Board, because it is both made a body politic and corporate. This, with its independent proprietary powers, of which I assume he's talking about no appropriation, the ability to issue bonds and other evidences of indebtedness and collect upon those bonds, or pay out the bonds and collect on indebtedness, this, with its independent propriety powers, constituted sui generis of itself. And I guess I'd like to hear how DOC, and you started out by saying, well, it's different from the 60s. Well, how is it different from the 60s in the terms of those principles that guide courts to determine what an independent body politic is vis-a-vis a state agency or department?
Because Majerus also said you do not need all of the Sullivan factors. Majerus did focus on some of those elements. So as I was discussing it, to me, is in essence a totality of the circumstances argument. Do you have an organization?
How is that argument affected, if at all, by the fact that in that case the Armory Board was attempting to say it was not an independent body politic?
I don't have a response to that.
All right. Please continue. And the red light is on, but we traditionally allow people to finish their thoughts.
I'll just real quick summarize. I think that the Mayhew case provides this court with an opportunity to at least clarify some things as far as sovereign immunity, what it means, and what clearly are the avenues of recovery, because as a practicing attorney out there, I'm really not totally sure when I look at these cases, and I did review them all. I think that sovereign immunity and some of the principles are outdated. I think that they're on balance. We haven't talked about there is a remedy. Everybody should have a remedy under Article 1, Section 9. I think in Mr. Mayhew's case that remedy is illusionary. And I appreciate the court's time, and thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Thank both counsel for their briefs and their oral argument today on an issue of sovereign immunity. We haven't had this issue before us most directly very recently, but have had it previously. And that concludes our argument in 2013 AP 1023, Adam Mayhew versus State of Wisconsin. The students can remain, and Justice Prosser will be out shortly to discuss them. The students will be joined by a group that appeared earlier, but about one that's going to come, and another group that will be at the court at 1:30. The court is therefore in recess.